You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 24th, 2024. Where's Yulia is a question the answer to which could uncover much more than the fate of a Russian woman disappeared from the public eye by the UK government more than 6 years ago. Knowing what happened to Yulia and her father, Sergei Skripal, could too begin to reveal the machinations creating the conditions for the war in Ukraine, currently grinding up the flower of a generation there, and threatening too an escalation of possibly nuclear proportions affecting everywhere else. Tim Norman is a veteran English journalist and editor working in local, national, and international media for daily, weekly, and monthly publications. Tim's followed the Skripal case from its beginnings, and his recent article at Propaganda in Focus, The Tragedy of Yulia Skripal, picks up the thread 6 years on as the story heads again for the front pages in Britain with the commencement of the Sturgis inquiry scheduled for the fall. Tim Norman in the first half. And polio has been detected in water samples taken in half a dozen locations in the Gaza Strip. Friday, Gaza's Ministry of Health said, quote, highly infectious polio virus had been identified at six locations in sewage samples collected by UNICEF on June 23rd from Khan Yunis and Deir al-Bala. UNICEF USA blames the ongoing bombardment of the Gaza Strip, which has targeted and destroyed more than two-thirds of the enclave's water and sanitation infrastructure. But Israel's introduction of one of the most feared human pathogens into the genocide struggles today to find press exposure amidst the daily atrocities. Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo is research coordinator for the Starling Center for Just Societies and Technologies at Western University, where she also teaches history. Dorothea, too, volunteers with the GLIA project, serving as its director of development, overseeing capacity building projects in Gaza. She writes her latest project, the Open Gaza Initiative, was, quote, interrupted by Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, shifting much of her focus on organizing and leading medical missions into the besieged Gaza Strip. Dorothea Gucciardo and Gaza from Eye Level in the second half. But first, Tim Norman and Finding Yulia Skripal. Welcome to the program, Tim.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Tim, you've written articles on the Skripal case, but more than this, you've been following this closely on Twitter from your perch at TimTron 2020. Tim, why this story? What's the fascination for you with Yulia and Sergei?
The Skripal case is something John Helmer, who's obviously a regular guest on your show, knows a great deal about. I'd say he's the sort of leading authority on the case. And as he pointed out on, I think, exactly a month ago when he was on your show talking about it last, he said, you know, it's a more important case even than the Assange case, because I think he was saying it led, or it certainly set the sort of atmosphere for the war in Ukraine. And so it produced manufactured consent, I suppose you could say, in the British public for this coming conflict with Russia. So I don't know if I entirely agree with John that the Assange case is more important. The Assange case is obviously very significant. And in fact, WikiLeaks did release some material in 2008 about Novichok, which of course is this nerve agent that was supposedly used in Salisbury against Sergei Skripal, and showed us that at the time Hillary Clinton was trying to suppress mention of Novichok among her sort of colleagues and underlings for reasons that not particularly clear, but perhaps sort of became clear 10 years later when it became this sort of propaganda assault. As John Helmer says, it's totally preposterous, the story, when you look at it in any detail. And yet it has become, it's been a success. It's been accepted by a large number of people at a sort of superficial level.
Well, Tim, wait a minute. I missed that about Hillary and Novichok. Why would Hillary, or why did it turn out Hillary was worried about Novichok coming to light?
Well, this is something that Moon of Alabama turned up around the time, just after the attack, or the alleged attack in 2018, because there was a whistleblower from the Novichok, it's called the Folient program, the Soviet nerve agent program that was developing these chemical weapons. And he ran away to America and wrote a book about it, and it published, in fact, the formula, or one of the formulae for Novichok. So it was in the public domain from 2008.
Right, because it was a big deal in the press case, it was a big deal that only the Soviets, the Russians, only the Russians were capable of manufacturing Novichok when, as John reported, and as is well known now, that there's many different countries have the technology to create this stuff, not just Russia.
Well, absolutely. I mean, David Colum, who's the professor of organic chemistry at Cornell University, that's to say, arguably the greatest or best research university in the world, he set it as a exam question for his first year chemistry students, and said, you know, can you synthesize this? So theoretically, but still, synthesize this nerve agent, and they all could, apart from one. So his whole class, first year chemistry students, was able to make it.
Maybe that was the one guy that made the Novichok that was used allegedly in this case, because I mean, we were all told that this stuff is just horrifyingly effective, and you know, a minute particle would mean instant and agonizing death. And yet, both Yulia and Sergei, allegedly poisoned by this substance, they both survived. In fact, everybody survived it. Nobody but Don Sturgis has died, and that didn't happen till months after the fact. And that in itself is a curious case that maybe we can get to as we move along. Yeah. But the idea of, now, so much has happened in Britain since in these last years. It's when we look back on it, it's such a condensed moment in history. You've gone through, what is it, five prime ministers or something like that since this poisoning took place. But the drumbeat against Russia was strong. This is before the war that currently roiling Ukraine had started in earnest, at least with the Russians getting overtly involved in it. What about this atmosphere and how this case, this attack, was leveraged to, as you say, create a consent within Britain for leading to a war that could have nuclear outcomes in the end?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, we've been through several prime ministers in the last parliament, but even the leader of the opposition, who's now the prime minister, Keir Starmer, he was fully in support of this narrative, the Salisbury narrative that Theresa May was coming out with when she was the prime minister at the time. And there really was no dissent at all in parliament, apart from possibly Jeremy Corbyn, who was Keir Starmer's predecessor, of course, as the Labour leader. He was obviously heavily smeared by everyone else, and so on, suggested that he was an agent of Putin and all this sort of thing, for questioning. And really, he was just asking for the evidence to be produced. As you'd expect in any sort of legal situation, you can't accuse someone without producing the evidence to back up your accusation. But all that was sort of kind of just bulldozed over, really. And I mean, another interesting point is that, and it's another thing that makes it so fascinating, is there was complete, almost complete unanimity across the press. So every journalist in every mainstream media outlet, with just one or two sort of notable exceptions, went along with this story, even though, as John Helmer or anybody else that's dug under the surface knows, it's quite preposterous when you look at the detail for any length of time. There are all kinds of questions arising from this story, and none of them were being asked. There's going to come a monolithic response from the mainstream media, just simply backing up what the government and the sort of, if you like, the security apparatus in the UK was saying. There was absolutely no space for any kind of journalism, effectively any kind of skepticism of authority, which is after all what, you know, journalists are supposed to do on behalf of the people in a democracy. So that's another very interesting aspect to it, that there's never really been any space for dissent, as I said. And that kind of ties in, for example, with COVID. For example, there was very little space for dissenting scientific voices at the time, and you can even tie that into the lockdown that happened, you know, obviously it's almost worldwide, but also there's a sort of kind of foreshadowing of that in Salisbury, where the population were terrified by this threat of a, you know, a sort of invisible, horrifying terror that was stalking the streets.
And this is 2018. So it was, before the COVID. And that term lockdown just drives me crazy because it was initially used to when referring to a prison. And you lock down the cells, you lock down the prisoners. So when you use that in a broader sense, it's getting us accustomed to the idea that we're actually not free citizens walking around living our lives, but we're prisoners that can be immediately sequestered at the whim of whomever. Tim, as well as your article, The Tragedy of Yulia Skripal, which is at Propaganda in Focus, which I recommend to everybody, you also have a fascinating timeline that you worked on up at ukcolumn.org called The Day of the Skripal, of course, the day of
Day of the Jackal.
Jackal, thank you.
Yeah, the assassination.
The Day of the Jackal springs to mind immediately. First, Tim, who's UK Column for our cross-Atlantic listeners? UKcolumn.org, and what's your association with them?
Well, I mean, I wrote that long article actually for Propaganda and Focus originally. It just grew to be an article of such size. It's sort of 25,000 words or something. And about 50 video clips from various sort of mainstream media outlets. And the UK Column is a sort of leading alternative, very credible, very well produced alternative news outlet that challenges the mainstream media narrative consistently over all kinds of issues, Syria, COVID, the war in Ukraine. It's consistently sort of challenged. As I say, the mainstream media have been done proper journalism, if you will, that's been so missing from the monolithic mainstream media that failed as continues to fail us, really.
Well, and so, Vanessa Bealey and Patrick Henningsen, two frequently appearing contributors there, have both been on this program in the past, Patrick a couple of times as well. Well, when you mention, Tim, that there's some issues about this that the press were... that seemed obvious, were obvious to me and obvious to you and obvious to John Helmer, but weren't being asked and picked up by the press. Where do you begin with your incredulity at what was being left out? Where were the first warning bells for you?
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious one, which I think John Helmer focused on when he last spoke to you, is this sort of near simultaneous onset. This is a story, this sort of timeline on UK Column or in the tragedy piece is something is trying to bring forward that you have these two very physically different people, a sort of overweight diabetic old man and a perfectly fit young woman, his daughter, who according to this narrative have touched a dermal exposure, so an uncontrolled exposure, and separately as well, they separately touched this stuff that supposedly had been applied to the door handle of Sergei's home. But then they go out in Salisbury and they have a lovely time for 3 or 4 hours. They go and feed ducks, they go to the pub, they go for a meal, and then they sit on this bench after sort of apparently showing no ill effects. This apparently CCTV of them walking just minutes before they were found on this bench, walking briskly through a sort of underpass. And but then they almost like a sort of switch has been turned on in their systems. They both collapse at almost the same time, with neither of them able to raise the alarm for the other. That's a sort of critical point, really. And I think that, that is in itself an extremely dubious proposition that would happen to anybody. Another fascination for the story is the way that the story has been kind of layered. The layers of deception seem to have been built up on top of it after this sort of initial event. So, for example, Bellingcat, which is this website that appears to be a proxy in some form for British intelligence, but apparently unmasked the two Russians who were accused of poisoning the Skripals. They then developed this strange story that the poison had been treated in a special way in Russian labs, very James Bond, called nano-encapsulation, to slow down its progress in order for the two Russians to get away, which is, stretching credulity a bit, and particularly then when you feed it into this story that we mentioned earlier about Dawn Sturgis, who died 4 months later, because she apparently found the murder weapon, which is a form of, or would be murder weapon, in the form of a perfume bottle, and sprayed it on herself, and according to her boyfriend, suffered symptoms within 15 minutes.
Yeah, her boyfriend, her surviving boyfriend, who Rowley, he found the perfume. This is as the story goes. He's a binner, and presented this unopened package of designer perfume to his paramour, who immediately said, "Charlie, you shouldn't have," and sprayed herself and then got sick and died. Charlie, in the direct proximity of this event, he survives as well. Did he even get sick?
He got sick. He certainly was in hospital. There's all sorts of strangeness around that because The Guardian reported that he received a kind of experimental nerve agent, or not experimental, but it was a nerve agent antidote that had been used for the first time ever in the UK. And this sort of was offered as an explanation for his survival, though it wasn't clear why he received it and Dawn Sturgis didn't. But he gave some interviews to ITV News, so mainstream media at the time, and they're fantastically inconsistent with the narrative. For example, he says that the bottle was boxed and sealed in hard plastic, and when he opened it, he spilled this chemical, so-called military-grade nerve agent on his hands and then washed it off. And so, that's why it took 8 hours or 6 to 8 hours for him to feel effects. So there's a strange one. And also, this narrative that he found it in a bin was really suggested to him by the ITV reporter. There's a bit of footage of him being driven around Salisbury by ITV. And he's saying, "Look, I have absolutely no idea where I found it. It could be in Salisbury. It could be in Amesbury. I have no idea at all where it came from." And the reporter says, "Well, it could have been in these bins." And he says, "Well, yeah, it could have been in these bins. So I did go through bins." But that's as much evidence as we have for it actually having been, discovered in a bin. And yet that is another part of the narrative that's again become sort of widely accepted as the narrative that explains how this, well, it doesn't explain how well this bottle was for 4 months. I mean, bins don't, Charlie Rowley himself says, they empty bins regularly. It can't have been the same bottle that the Russians used to poison Skripal's door. He says that in an interview with The Guardian.
Well, when you mentioned Tim Bellingcat, Bellingcat is the organization, and you said, I can't remember how you described them, but being a rather suspect and a spy world adjacent organization, not very journalistic at all. And in fact, the journalist in scare quotes, Paul Mason, even some of his leaked or intercepted emails describe Bellingcat as a tool, I'm paraphrasing, but as a tool of MI6 and MI5 and Elliot Higgins. I'm not sure if you mentioned him at all. Is Elliot Higgins, by the way, is he still even involved with Bellingcat? I don't see his name.
Yes, I think he is. I don't know. I mean, he published a book, of course, We Are Bellingcat. So he is still the front man, I think, in most people's minds. And of course, the book We Are Bellingcat has its inconsistencies again with various details of the story. This terrible conflict between his version of events and Mark Urban's version of events. He's the BBC reporter that's very close to Pablo Miller, possibly, who was Sergei Skripal's handler.
And he was writing a book before the poisoning took place. Urban was, and so he and Helmer talks about this quite a lot. I only mention this because these two, the two Russians were outed as spies by Bellingcat, if I remember the story, initially. Am I getting that right?
No, that's absolutely right. Well, they were outed as being members of the GRU, or possibly ex-members of the GRU. As you say, are you ever not a spy? Christopher Steele, who's this sort of mixed up in this because he...
Getting back to Hillary again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, he's an ex MI6, but he's a contractor, and he was contracted by Hillary to write this sort of salacious dossier on Trump back in 2016. And there's a suggestion that Sergei was brought in to make it sort of look more authentically Russian. So again, you just sort of apply reason to this, it's speculation, but you could suggest, well, Sergei's the kind of guy who sells secrets. That's what he's done all his career. He's pretty mercenary. Maybe he's got some secrets to sell, or maybe these two guys have something to do with that. But, he's got something to tell them, or possibly trade, because he's very homesick to go back to Russia. These are all just sort of ideas that are out there in the ether that I kind of come across or think about.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Tim Norman. Tim's a veteran English journalist and editor. He works in local, national, and international media for daily, weekly, and monthly publications. And he's followed this Skripal case, this weird and winding case that has had such massive repercussions and continues to. I mean, considering what's going on in Russia and how we still hear, Tim, in the English press and over here as well, allusions to this case when there's any need to vilify Russia even a little bit more, along with other actors, Navalny and so forth, the Skripal case is still a major talking point. But it's nothing certain about it for sure. And actually, even if it was designed to be, it has certainly been used as a propaganda tool. I'm curious, Tim, about now, you know, we were beginning with the case of Yulia Skripal. We haven't talked much about Yulia, but you say it's your article is the tragedy of Yulia Skripal. The tragedy is she's been 6 years disappeared. The story sort of floated out, not explicitly spelled out by the UK government, is, oh, she's alive and well and living maybe in New Zealand with Sergei close by under protection in case the Russians try to do something to them. The Russians had Sergei in prison for many years, never mind about that. Yulia seems to be perhaps just collaterally affected by all this. It's strange to me, Tim, and you write about it, that Yulia was engaged to be married. She was visiting Sergei in England, but she lives in Russia. Her boyfriend, though, her fiancé, Stepan Vikev, forgive Stepan the pronunciation, he's an interesting character too, and even more so because has he yet been found?
Well, I didn't dig too deeply into his story, but yes, he's a sort of thought to be the son of a woman who's got connections with the Russian Secret Service. There's sort of echo in there for me of the way that when Edward Snowden ended up in Russia, his partner, now wife, sort of ended up being able to move out to live with him. So, you know, perhaps if this idea that Yulia is in New Zealand, then he's somehow, you know, been sort of spirited away and is living with her. And if that's true, I mean, I very much hope that is the case, because as you say, it's a sort of on its face, she's just sort of collateral damage in this sort of vendetta, a kind of rather sort of illogical, mindless vendetta that President Putin apparently has against relatively minor traitors from 10 years ago, traitors to the motherland, and she's been caught up in it and her life has been destroyed, which that's the sort of thrust of the article that I wrote. But I was writing it as I did with the day of the Skripal, just presenting the, if you like, the official version of events, just so the reader can see by reading through them how improbable even a sort of sober retelling of what we're supposed to believe actually is. I mean, other people might suggest that, you know, her being there wasn't a coincidence, and she was somehow caught up in the, or, you know, involved in the events more directly. But again, we don't know that. But superficially, she was just a sort of a bystander who got caught up in it. I mean, I wish her well wherever she is. I don't really see, and I don't think anybody else who's kind of thinks rationally about it would see why she can't give testimony in some secure form. And as I said in the article, Sergei hasn't even produced a written statement about what he simply vanished on the 4th of March 2018, and it's never been heard of since. And these are, of course, the principal witnesses in a case, as we said at the beginning, that could drive humanity to apocalypse. I mean, we're just it's all being used to sort of ramp up this sort of ever escalating tension with Russia on these terribly, well, John Helmer says, preposterous sort of basis. It's really quite absurd.
Yulia, she is, as you described her, she's fit enough. She survived okay. And in fact, she gave a video presentation after the fact. I can't remember how long, maybe a month or something after the actual fact, was it? Correct me on the timeline there, Tim. But she looked terrific, and there was actually jokes, memes online about Novichok being this beauty enhancer, you know, print it, because she actually looked better than before, dare I say, better than before the incident, you know, slimmer and well coiffed and everything else and nicely dressed, save for a big hole in her throat that she didn't wear a scarf or anything to protect. I don't want to fall into the stereotype that women are all vain and everything, but anybody, I think, would, you know, cover up this big scar that she had on her throat from being intubated. What about this video, Tim?
Well, yes, I mean, that's a very strange part of the story. Of course, it wasn't in any way an interview. I mean, it was sort of described as an interview in the mainstream media, but obviously she took no questions. She just read out a script that she had possibly written. She made various sort of cryptic comments, the most significant of which was that she, in the longer term, she wanted to go back home to her own country. So, you know, clearly didn't feel under direct threat from Putin or Putin's successor, or some people suggested she meant after President Putin had stepped down or whatever. But there's nothing in there. As she emphasises very much strongly that no one can speak on her behalf. And of course, pretty much everybody has since then, that want to defend the story and say, well, obviously she doesn't want to speak. She doesn't want to expose herself to danger. But, you know, we don't know that. All we know is that since this very bizarre speech to camera, statement to camera, which was given at RAF Fairford, it was about 6 weeks, I think, after the initial poisoning, perhaps a bit later than that. I'll have to check. Yeah, so for a US air base in the UK, she was sort of kind of geolocated there, giving this strange statement. As I said, and as you said, with this very clear tracheostomy scar in her neck, which you have to surmise she was sort of told not to cover up because people, I think, ordinarily would not want to show that kind of scar in public, having appeared. So it was the sort of statement, I think, that she had had a procedure and she was possibly obliged to show that she had had a procedure, a tracheostomy, to sort of show the severity, as it were, of the ordeal she'd been through and the effects of this this poison. I mean,
and if you see the video or even still photographs taken from it, the contrast of her presentation with nice makeup and her hair looks even professionally done. Surmise, well-dressed and everything, and all looking very nice with a bucolic background, despite being on this airbase, as you describe, you know, like in a garden space somewhere on this airbase. And then this big gashing scar in her throat, it's jarring. She did manage to get a phone call out, allegedly, I mean, how certain are we, to her cousin in Russia, Victoria. What about that call? First, do you think that it's legit, what we know about it? And was it just a mistake on the part of the security apparatus to allow that this happen?
I tend to that point of view. I mean, if you listen to the interviews with the medical staff, which again are on YouTube, some of the Salisbury medics revealed.
None of which died or anything, being in contact with Novichok.
And they're quite clear at the opening sort of part of their interviews that they took no precaution. There was no suggestion at the time the Skripals were admitted to Salisbury Hospital that they'd been exposed to any kind of military-grade nerve agent. They had been diagnosed with a suspected opiate overdose. So there was no barrier nursing. There was no particular security measures taken by the medics. And they were absolutely astonished, you know, first of all, with this diagnosis of nerve agent poison, which was given to them by Portland Down, which is, of course, the chemical weapons facility that the UK operates just down the road in Salisbury. And then subsequently that they survived, you know, they couldn't expect. But anyway, it's clear from the medics that they were friendly with Sergei and Yulia. And I think Yulia was given a phone, perhaps by one of the nurses, in order to be able to call her cousin in Russia and say things were okay. And I think that changed the nature of the narrative at that point. I don't know for certain if we would have even heard from Yulia, as we haven't heard from Sergei, had this not happened. It's true that Victoria, her cousin, was convinced that she was talking to Yulia when she received this phone call. As you say, we can't be certain. The BBC wouldn't verify it, and it hasn't been verified. And John Helmer has sort of noted there were a couple more phone calls that were made. The other one I find less credible, actually, than this one from the hospital, where she has a call a couple of years later where she sort of is walking around in nature and sort of says, you know, hoping to go to New Zealand, and father's okay, but he's got a nurse who's looking after him.
This was with the grandmother, right, who's since deceased.
Yes.
Well, Tim, sorry to step in, Tim. We're just getting going, but we're out of time. This Zoom's going to cut me off in any moment. At your site, again, if you go on to Twitter, it's at Tim Tron 2020. 20, and you, yeah. And you can follow this. And there you have a quote by a Canadian. So I'll get a Canadian connection in here, Marshall McLuhan, saying, "Only the small secrets need to be protected. The big ones are kept secret by public incredulity." Well, absolutely. Never has that statement been more true than today. And certainly in this case, where we will find out in maybe in the fall more when